start? Okay, welcome to the second last session. First up, we've got Gervais Markham on keeping certificate authorities honest using Mozilla's Root Certificate Program.
Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. My name is Gerv. I'm with Mozilla. And one of the things I do for them is that I help run Mozilla's Root Certificate Program. Now, there are a number of different ways that you can establish a secure connection between two points on the internet. But it turns out, different ways have different pros and cons, but it turns out the best way, if you have a user who doesn't want to care about security or cryptography or any of that stuff, the best and easiest to use way is probably the certificate system. This is where your web browser reaches out to a site across the internet, and the site sends back a certificate that says, I'm definitely Amazon. Your web browser says, okay, is this certificate signed by someone I trust to attest to identity? Oh, it is? Okay, that must be Amazon then. And off it goes, and you connect to Amazon, and the user doesn't have to care very much. So a root program then is basically managing the list of companies that you trust to attest to this is Amazon, this is PayPal, this is Facebook, this is Microsoft. So a number of different companies provide this service, and ideally they would all be competent, trustworthy, fine, upstanding members of the community. And this talk is about what happens when they're not. So I help run Mozilla's root program. As I said, the root program is managing that list. So the people who have one, so Mozilla has one for Firefox, and is often picked up by other organizations who don't want to run their own root programs and appreciate the way we run ours. But also Microsoft has one for Windows and IE, Apple has one for OS X, iOS and Safari, Google has one for Chrome, Android, well, Chrome sort of, because sometimes Chrome just does whatever OS it's running on does, but Android. Oracle has one, which is a little bit different. Adobe has one for document signing, so it's not just about direct connections between between computers, it can be about secure email, it can be, there are different things you can trust these companies for. But Mozilla is particularly focused on SSL connections and on email. And the reason there's more than one is because the idea that there should be a single authority in the world telling everybody who to trust is probably as great an idea as it sounds just when I say it. So the different root programs often have a lot of commonality in which companies they trust for this, but there are definitely some differences. Microsoft, for example, trusts a whole bunch of people that we don't. The issues that causes is that, of course, you know, sometimes you find a website works in one browser and not another. Now, Mozilla's root program is different because we try very hard to run our root program in an open and transparent fashion. So all of the decisions we make, our policy positions are discussed and documented, and anyone can come along and join in. And your contribution is valued based on how sane it is rather than on who you work for. So we try very hard to do that. But the great thing as well is that because being trusted in Firefox is something that certificate authorities want, they listen to what we say when we tell them to do things, which means that we have power over them that we can use for good to drive up the, if you like, the lower bar of best practice in the industry and to generally make the internet more secure. So, for example, some of the things that we have done in that vein are about 10 years ago, an organization formed called the Certificate Authority Browser Forum, and we used that to drive up validation standards. So certificate authorities were putting information in their certificates about who the company was, not just the domain name, but like this is a company called PayPal Inc. and their headquarters here. But the way they were checking that often involved dodgy faxes of letterheads and other stuff like that, which wouldn't really stand up to much fraud prevention. So we wrote a set of standards about how you actually check someone's identity, and that became the extended validation standard. And in some browsers now, you get a little green bar that tells you who the company are, as well as what URL they have. We used this power to eliminate 10-24-bit RSA certificates, which were reaching the end of their useful life. So there were several root certificates in the browser, and therefore a whole bunch of certificates issued off them that were being used, and we forced certificate authorities to move away from those so that we could get rid of them. And so if anyone ever does manage to factor one of those certificates and therefore had the ability to issue certificates underneath it, that wouldn't be a problem anymore because we didn't trust it anymore. A little bit later, again in the Certificate Authority Browser Forum, we did some things called the baseline requirements, which were about raising the things that everybody has to do, the lower level of the industry. We've done a thing to provide more transparency in the ecosystem by getting all the certificate authorities to tell us about the shape of their certificate hierarchies. And more recently, we've done some work on improving some of the slightly dodgy methods people were using to answer the question, does this person who's asking for a certificate actually own that domain that they're asking for it for? Again, there was some dodgy practices going on, and we've now standardized some best practice in that area. So, that's all very well, but the interesting thing that you would like to hear about is all of the nasty nefariousness when CAs don't do what they're supposed to be doing. Now, it tends to be that there's about one significant CA incident a year. But back in 2011, we were blessed with two, and probably the two most famous ones, at least until recently. The first one was when involved a certificate authority called Komodo. This incident was known as Komodo Gate, and the guy who was never caught was known as Komodo Hacker. He got into one of Komodo's partners in Italy, who had poor security, and then their connection to Komodo had poor security, so he was able to issue a bunch of certificates for sites like Google and Mozilla. He may or may not have been connected with Iran. The result of that was we made some now seemingly quite tame, but at the time, you know, quite significant in terms of actually asking certificate authorities, you have to do this, changes. So we had made them use two-factor authentication for all of their logins, for all of their partners, that kind of thing. So then there was that. And then even more disastrous was a Dutch CA called DigiNotar. They were completely owned, so owned that no one really knows quite how badly owned they were even now. And they tried to, you know, as they discovered this, they tried to hide it and didn't tell the root programs. Whoever owned them definitely had connections with the Iranian government, because the certificates that were issued off DigiNotar's routes were used for several months to man-in-the-middle Iranian citizens. Now, this video I'm about to show you is from the logs of the certificate authority, which were later taken by a security company who was doing the checking of all the bad things that had gone wrong. And each dot represents a browser checking in to say, is this certificate good for one of these dodgy certificates? And the answer came back, yes, it's fine. And I'll tell you why that is in a minute. But each of those dots represents one of those connections. So each of these dots represents someone. I took that video out. Now I've talked about it, I'm going to have to show it to you, aren't I? Give me a second. It is a good video. Well, good as in, good in the kind of, this makes me want to cry kind of way. There you go. Okay, so each dot represents someone being man in the middle by the Iranian government. And time is progressing down there. This is August 2011. The dots outside Iran are probably Tor exit nodes, so that the logs had an odd view of where the people were. But we suspect, that is a lot of dots, right? And we have no idea what kind of impact this had on people in Iran who wanted to communicate in ways that the government didn't like. So this kind of thing really shows you that this stuff is serious. And getting this right and making sure certificate authorities are not terrible is important. So what did we do about DigiNotar? We distrusted the entire organisation, obviously. It took us a week or two longer than maybe it should have done. The baseline requirements that we talked about, we started writing those so that hopefully no one would be quite this incompetent again. We made it so that when you say to a CA, is this certificate good? And the CA goes, I've never heard of that certificate. They're not allowed to go, yeah, sure, must be fine. Right? And, you know, that kind of seems obvious, but it turns out that those systems were backed up by lists of bad certificates. So if it wasn't on the list of known bad certificates, they would just go, yeah, whatever. Right? And that took a significant change to make. And we also wrote some network security guidelines so that hopefully CAs would do at least some sensible things to do with their network security. Although 5 years on, those have not changed. Now CAs are complaining that they're actually stopping them doing what is now best practice. So we're looking at removing those and replacing them with something written by some people who know more about network security than we did 5 years ago. We being the Certificate Authority Browser Forum. So anyway, that was the DigiNotar. And like I said, there have been more of these at the rate of about one a year of various differing levels of severity. But the interesting one I want to talk to you about particularly today is the story of Wosine and Startcom. Wosine was a Chinese CA, and Startcom was an Israeli CA. And the issues that we found started with Wosine, which we were detecting having various problems with issuing certificates that were in all ways correct and technically competent and so on. And there were enough of these issues that we started an investigation. And as we investigated, we found them doing even more nefarious things. And one thing in particular we found them doing is something called SHA-1 backdating. Now, SHA-1 is a cryptographic hash algorithm which is used in the construction of certificates. And for many years, it's been known to be dodgy and has been getting increasingly obviously dodgy. And so a few years ago, the industry worked out under... reluctantly and under pressure from the browsers, the certificate authority industry worked out a timeline for its deprecation, a key date in which was the 1st of January 2016, after which you were no longer allowed to issue SHA-1 certificates. Okay? The trouble is that the issue date that's embedded in a certificate is controlled by the CA, which means that the CA can set that backwards and pretend the certificate was issued last year when it was in fact issued this year, and it's somewhat hard to tell. But it turns out we busted them. So, this is a graph of Wosine SHA-1 issuances. And as it turns out, certificates are issued using templates which set the fields in a certain way. And then we could see that they were using two different templates. Now, we'll probably like the light green. But the light green is type X, which is one template, which is being issued, this is the last 3 months of 2015. This is being issued every day, a little bit less at the weekend, but at any time of day or night, every day, that's an automated system. Right? But the orange ones are only issued on weekdays in much smaller numbers, and they're only issued during the day. And that suggests these are manually issued. Right? Now, none of them are issued on Saturday and Sunday. Well, there's a couple here on Saturdays. And then suddenly, on the 20th of December 2015, it seems like they issued 63 certificates on a Sunday. Oh, okay. Well, that was obviously a busy day. And then, if you plot the time distribution of those issuances, all of the orange ones are during the day Chinese time. This is UTC. You can even detect the lunch break here. Right? The blue ones from the 20th of December were issued all through the day, which strongly suggests that they were not issued on the 20th of December at all, but were issued later at a random date on a date just before the deadline was inserted in order to make it look like they were issued before the ban came into place. So, we then found some cryptographic evidence that this was true. Google has a system called Certificate Transparency, and sometimes you have to submit your certificates there in order for them to work in Chrome. Six of them were submitted, and they were submitted in January, not in December, and February. So it was pretty clear that they were doing this to try and get around this ban. And then they bought the CA called Startcom, but denied they'd done so. Now, Mozilla requires that if CAs change hands, you tell us, because trust isn't transferable. So if the government of Kazakhstan decides to buy a CA, we might want to stop trusting it, given that the government of Kazakhstan has on several occasions said that they would like to man in the middle all their citizens. So we require them to tell us if control changes. And we said, did you buy Startcom? And they're like, no, no. And then we found all of the corporate records via the UK and Hong Kong that said that they had, and they were like, oh, well, maybe we did. And then Wosine compelled Startcom to issue two backdated SHA-1 certificates for an Australian payments company, showing that Wosine's management was having an influence on Startcom, and so we distrusted the lot of them in October 2016. Startcom are allowed back in starting about now, if they can get their act together, which they're doing. Wosine have a lot more that they need to do before we will ever trust them again. And we don't really know whether that'll ever happen. So that was a fun detective story. If you want to read more about how that went down, there is a 12-page report that I wrote, which is available online, the URL is at the end, which no less a person than Swift on Security said that, look, if you can write a 12-page page turn about CA scuzziness, then wow, you can write. So, thank you. More interesting, 2017, onto a different thing, Symantec. Symantec are the largest CA in the industry. They're a bit of a behemoth. They're the people are talking about when they worry about CAs being too big to fail. The first thing that we discovered in January was that they had some problems, or there were some problems at a Korean company called CrossCert, And issued some dodgy certificates. So we looked into that, and it turned out they were issuing certificates in Symantec's hierarchy. And it turned out that Symantec basically had four or five of these partners in this program that they were keeping absolutely no eye on whatsoever, and who had complete freedom of issuance, pretty much. And then, of course, we start investigation, and as you do, when you look at things, you find more things, and there were other things from the past, and we've turned up enormous chunks of Symantec's certificate system which don't have the right audits, and no one's keeping an eye on, and it's all really very dodgy. So this is a bit of an ongoing situation which is starting to make the press, and in fact made Symantec's fourth quarter earnings call. Got a little bit of a mention in that, which is quite interesting. They're a very big company. Certificates is only a small part of what they do these days. So that's an ongoing situation. So watch this space for more on that. Okay, that's 15 minutes, and there are other people. So I have 5 minutes for questions. Yes.
And now we've got Ian Hutchinson on digital rights and exploits and the missing usability layer.
All right.
Hopefully.
It's always a surprise when that happens. It's fantastic.
Right. Cool. Very quickly, before I get started, a show of hands, please. Who here is a developer? Very good. Who here is a designer? Yes. And who here is involved with policy or anything like that? Nice, nice. One last thing. Who here likes Eurovision? Yes, I am in the right crowd. Fantastic. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ian Hutchinson, and I work at a design studio called Projects by If. Every Monday morning, we start our week with this really great ritual. They're called intelligence reports, and it's where each of us on the team, we come in and we share the latest happenings in privacy and security. And the reason why we do this is because it helps us keep up to date with the areas that we work in as a design studio. And if you forget all the terrible things which Uber have done recently, I've noticed these emerging trends, and one of these trends is about poorly made IoT products. So here's a couple of examples. This is called Cloud Pets, and it's a way to allow parents and children to share voice messages with each other. I think that's a really compelling use of technology, but the company that made it was a bit lax with their security. First of all, their back-end database, they didn't secure it properly, and that exposed the data of half a million people's personal data. Secondly, talking about these audio files and voice messages, they didn't secure their cloud storage system properly, meaning that you could pretty much guess a URL and listen to someone's voice messages without any kind of authentication. And I admit, that's a bit of a niche example, but let me tell you about something closer to home. You might remember back in October last year that there was a DDoS attack on some DNS servers. I remember this quite personally because it was on a Friday, and it took down Netflix and Just Eat, and without those two things, Friday night is just absolutely ruined. But this particular router, which was supplied by Deutsche Telekom, one of its ports was left open. And that meant that anyone could go in and modify the firmware and actually make them become part of these botnets. And it's worrying that these things are happening right in our homes. And as a final example, this is a smart television made by Samsung. And this was known for its very terrible privacy policy, which basically meant that the voice commands, which you use to control this remotely, they were sold off to make a profit from that data. But the way that they were transferred to an external server didn't use any encryption, and when you consider the kind of conversations we have in our living rooms and having that kind of information just pumped out there with any sort of protection, that's really scary. So, on reflection, I thought that, you know, these stories aren't just about poorly made products. These are stories about people's digital rights being undermined. And what our digital rights are, they're still being sketched out. We have things like the General Data Protection Regulation, which starts to figure that out. But more often than not, we look to our consumer rights and our human rights to understand what our digital rights are. I'm really interested in the space where digital rights and exploits intersect, because exploits break the things we use in really subtle ways. For example, they can cause our data to be leaked, harming our right to privacy. What's important is that we need some new tools to help people, help everyone, understand when their digital rights are being undermined. So what does this look like now? So this is the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures Database, and it goes alongside something else called the National Vulnerabilities Database. Both these tools are run by the US government, which these days is a bit of a red flag. There's also things like mailing lists and for security and the researchers of security websites. And the thing about this is that they're not made for a general audience, they're made for a technical audience. They lack this really important usability layer to allow everyone to find out how their devices are broken. But there are some organisations which are doing some really good work in bringing this usability layer. This is a website called Have I Been Owned, and it allows you to pop in your email address and check whether you've been affected by any recent data breaches. It's a dead simple interface which allows you to find out when your digital rights have been undermined and then take action to secure your data. And I really like the flow that they put in to allow you to check whether you've been part of a, you know, particularly sensitive data breach. This website needs a bit of love, but this is Terms of Service Didn't Read. It takes the unwieldy terms and conditions that we're faced with when we sign up to digital services and boils them down into really simple good and bad bullet points. What I really like about this is that they've classified all these different digital services into classes, which means you can see how your rights change relative to different services. At the design studio that I work at, Projects by IF, we've been looking at this problem of the missing usability layer through the lens of consumer organisations. These organisations have a great heritage in fighting for the rights of consumers. We're talking about organisations like Which in the UK and Consumer Reports in the US, and they all grew out of the consumer advocacy movement, which was helped by this guy, John F. Kennedy, in the 60s. He called on Congress to pass laws to help protect the emerging consumer society which came out after the Second World War. And over the years that this society has existed, it's protected us from things like dangerous design flaws in cars and having to fit our own plugs on domestic appliances. And those were the dangers of a different kind of market. Because of data-driven connected objects, the danger has changed. And we think that consumer rights organisations need to adapt to that. So something we did last year is that we embarked on a research project to try to figure out what these digital products and services that consumer rights organisations could make. This is something called the log, and it's essentially a map of all the connected objects in your home. You can tap on an object on the map, and you can see a feed of changes. And what we want to do is sort of expose these hidden changes in our connected products to people more clearly. And we're talking things like terms and conditions changes, software updates, and you know, also things like when the warranty runs out on the product that you bought. There's a consumer organisation in Australia called Choice, and they were really interested in the work that we were doing in this area. And they asked us to join them on a 7-week research project to help understand how people could be made more aware of what's going on with their home networks. We had a really great resource to our disposal, and this is the Choice Online Members Community, and it's full of really passionate people about consumer advocacy. We have all sorts of people talking about all sorts of different things, and it gave us an audience to allow us to put prototypes in front of, find out what people's feedback was, and then iterate in a really meaningful way. We started off this research by asking people a simple and deceptively vague question: what are your 5 most frequently used electrical products at home? We had our own hunches about what people were using through prototypes like the log, but we really wanted to tailor what we were making to the Choice community. And here's what we found out from that question. As you'd expect, people have lots of laptops, desktop computers, smartphones and tablets. Something that we didn't expect was how many people were using digital subscription TV boxes. I guess what we'd done is we'd overestimated the emergence of this idea of cord-cutting, which is where people get rid of things like Sky TV and head for things like Netflix and other websites like Amazon Prime. Another thing that took us by surprise was the amount of people that didn't have these new data-driven connected products in their home, things like wearables and smart meters for home thermostats. We found that people also included their non-connected appliances when we asked this question. And I think there's a really interesting design challenge in how do we accommodate for these things, which may soon be connected in the future. So after that first question, we almost turned the tables on the community and we asked them to ask us five questions, five things that they want to know about the products that they own. And the reason why we did this was because we wanted to figure out what the problems the community were thinking about so we could tailor it to them again, but also have an idea of the kind of data sets which we'd need to build services around in order to deliver this information to people. And it would also give us an idea of the kind of gaps there were in these data sets. Knowing what to buy was the biggest area, and that was because, you know, a lot of people experience the work of these consumer organisations through things like product reviews and product recommendations. People have things which break, and people want to know what those things can do. But there's this really interesting area around compatibility, and I remember this one story where someone was talking about two bits of television equipment and whether they connect to each other because one is newer. And I was thinking, to find out if you could do that, you'd have to find a PDF manual on the manufacturer's website, and that information can't be wrapped up into services. And I think there's a really compelling service somewhere in there that would really help a lot of people. As a design studio, we have a focus on security and privacy, but what we found was that people weren't talking about this as often as we expected. But as we'd find out later in the research project, this is a thing that people don't think about as a standalone concept. And finally, one of the biggest areas was home networks and internet. And to understand why, let me tell you quickly about broadband in Australia. So at the beginning of this decade, I think 2009 actually, the Australian government set out on a multi-billion dollar infrastructure project called the National Broadband Network. And the idea was, in order for Australia to compete in the new digital global economy, they would have to replace all the old copper wiring and replace it with new satellite broadband technology, mobile broadband technology, and fibre to the home. But according to this is the latest statistics about world broadband speeds, 51st place in the world leaves a lot to be desired, and that's something which the choice community reflected. So we took that as one of the ways of framing our further bits of research. We were interested in troubleshooting because I felt like people found a lot of pain through that sort of process. And we wanted to explore security and privacy in more detail, given that it wasn't a thing that people thought about as a standalone thing. On the back of that, we built three prototypes that looked at this problem from different angles. So who should I ask for help? This was someone who didn't know whether to call Apple for support with their broadband or the actual broadband provider, because they didn't know which part of the network was broken. Is my internet slow at particular times was around taking all the data points about broadband performance, packaging them up into a way which people could understand and get more insight from. And can strangers use my Wi-Fi? That's about creating interfaces which allows people to better secure their Wi-Fi networks. While we were doing this, Choice were actually working on a new kind of home router. And I really like routers because they're an interesting intervention point in the home network. They have an idea of everything that's going on inside the home and also everything to do with the external broadband connection. We created an interface for this touchscreen router that they've been playing with. And we designed it so it would fall away when everything was fine, but allowed you to interact with it when something was wrong. For example, we could take all the different data sets about your home internet connection and the home network that are usually hidden inside of settings and really bring them out and really make them useful to people. We also thought about collecting this data locally so we could create more meaningful insights about people's connections. Going back to the idea of security not being a standalone thing, we tried to introduce new ideas around security. So, for example, if a product that had connected to your network that you'd never seen before connected to your network, we get a notification about it and allow you to block it, perhaps. And I think this idea really talks about the idea of security being a thread which runs through how we experience the internet connectivity, not being a standalone thing which is separate. The other night I actually went on Choice's website and I was really happy to see that they've uploaded all the sort of prototypes that we've made, and they have some source code on GitHub which allows you to try some of these features, for example, blocking getting notifications about new devices connected to your network. If you get a Raspberry Pi in the official Raspberry Pi touchscreen, you can put an image on an SD card and give it a go. And the website for that is choice.ventures, and I never knew that Ventures was a TLD until when I found out. This idea of the missing usability layer is an urgent problem. It's becoming easier to put the internet in things. On one end of the spectrum, you have small startups trying to get the next big thing in technology. And on the other hand, you have companies that, you know, have created things before but are moving into this new space of data-driven connected technology. I think these companies don't have the expertise to think holistically about security and privacy design. And also because good security and privacy design is a mixture of good code, good design, and good policy. Something we've been doing at IF to try and encourage this multidisciplinary approach is something called the Trust and Design Meetup. And it's a way of getting all sorts of different people from product teams, like developers and designers and policy people together, to think about new ways of doing consent, which goes beyond terms and conditions. We had our first one in April, and we'll be announcing when the next one is soon, so please follow us at projectsbyif to find out when the next one is. As many of us here probably think is true, we're strong believers in rights, and particularly digital rights. And one of the reasons why I work at IF is because I want to make things which help improve people's digital rights and their ability to enforce them. If you share that message and you have these ideas and you want to build products which help people, empower people, then talk to me later. It'd be great to chat. Thank you very much. I have 4 minutes if anyone has any questions, so it's going to have to be quick. Yes, sir.
Has Mattel's Aristotle appeared on your radar yet?
Sorry?
Mattel's Aristotle, have you come across that yet?
I honestly, I see so many of these awful IT products that...
It's apparently puts TV and a sound recorder in your kiddie's bedroom for it to chat to.
Exactly, and there's another example from Germany where they banned this toy called My Little Kayla, I think it was called.
Yes.
Because they legally classified it as a surveillance device, which is worrying because we're dealing with people sort of below the age of meaningful consent in terms of their data, and they can't make these decisions, and parents don't have the information either to, you know, make those meaningful decisions on their behalf. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
I was following online a product called the Freedom Box. Mm. It never seems to be quite ready. I wonder if you know of anything similar available now.
I've seen something called, I think it's called Dojo, which is a IoT monitoring device that kind of looks at what's happening on your network. And, you know, these are pretty sort of niche devices, I think, because there's not been any work done in kind of usability to bring them into a general audience. I also know Thing, which originally was an app for your iPhone to understand what was on your network, is starting to move into the hardware area as well. But again, still a pretty niche object, and it'd be really good to see these things aimed at more general consumers. All right, thanks everyone.
And now we've got Esther on recognising hybrid war and strategic disinformation attacks.
Ooh, what's that all about then? Disclaimer, I'm a stand-in talk, so I'm not the person you thought was going to talk, and this talk isn't going to be as technically minded as the previous two talks in the thread. So if the idea of taking a bigger picture look at kind of threats to open society isn't your cup of tea, I will absolutely not be offended if you use your 2 feet and go somewhere where you think you're having more fun or learn more. That being said, I'll turn around just for a moment. As it's a pop-up talk, I don't have any of my slide crime to offend you with, so I'll just, full disclosure, this is my Twitter name. If I say anything you want to rant about on Twitter, I'm Esco @Reiniger. Right. So, it's phonetic. right, for Finns. Quick intro. I'm a Finnish citizen. That means I have been conscripted into the Finnish army. That means until the age of 55, I'm still liable to be called up for military service. That means that when I look at kind of brewing threats in our environmental, in our kind of global environment and the rebalancing of geopolitical forces, for me, the really shit hits the fan outcome is not an abstract thing that happens over there. It's I get a letter, I have to go back to Finland, I have to pick up my equipment, and I'm most likely going to die in a foxhole on the Eastern Front. So it's a very tangible thing, right? And that's why I'm particularly worried about it, and I study this quite a lot. And what I'm going to try to do today is share some understanding about the doctrines that are being used against open societies, not because I want to kind of inculcate you in a particular worldview, not because I want to tell you what to do about it, but because I want to use my 15 minutes here to maybe help you be able to recognize things that are deliberately attacking your systems. Does that sound all right? If you can still leave if you're... Yeah, I've got some news. Right, cool. So let's talk a little bit about the idea of warfare. We have this, our traditional view of warfare is kinetic warfare. So you know that a war is going on when you see tanks rolling over a border and you see planes and big explosions and the whole CNN circuit shows up to do like live 24 streaming of war. And it turns out that that is a traditional form of war that we very rarely see, and even if we do see it, we become so desensitized to it. So for example, there's a war going on right now in Europe since 2014 in which 10,000 people have been killed by kinetic violence. That's happening in Ukraine, right? And unless some new spike, some particularly egregious thing happens, gets shot down full of civilians, it's kind of in the background, right? It's not in our in the front of our mind. And this idea that kind of the idea that war is very distant and away from us is very deliberately engineered, right? Because now we exist in a period of time in which the new doctrines of war, and here I use war in Clausewitzian terms, so the continuation of politics by other means, in a hybrid war context, kinetic war is only one just kind of marginal edge of it. Also here I'm talking to you in Britain, right? We have a physical sea that creates a psychological distance from all of this stuff, which makes it even a little bit more abstract. Hybrid war, on the other hand, is like full spectrum techniques that go into things like strategic disinformation, polluting the information landscape. And this is the bit that I'm going to deconstruct a little bit to so that we know what are the different elements that are going on in this hybrid war, and then we can make a judgment as to whether those things are impacting on our lives and the kind of political narratives that we're involved in these days. Another thing I'll say by way of intro and like disclaimer is I'm from Eastern Finland. Culturally, we are very aligned and in tune with the Russian people. I'm a deep lover of the Russian people. I have very good friends from Russia. Their culture is beautiful, all of that. So when I talk about Russia in the next coming bit, I'm actually talking about the Putin regime, right? Which most of my Russian friends don't sympathize, but they don't have very many choices or agency to do anything about it. Yeah? Okay. Before we go into the elements of hybrid warfare, let's think a bit about the attack surface for it. And here I'll do you a very quick diagram. So traditionally in our political lives, there's this left to right political spectrum. And our leaders offer us a narrative somewhere on this spectrum and say, at the point of elections, you choose which is the most compelling one. That's going to govern the way that we get led. And then we have this kind of idea that we have got some agency in the way that our political story evolves. Now, I would argue that recently, in recent days, if this is a very kind of blunt math going on, but if you look at like the voter turnouts and you normalize them across all different levels of elections, from local elections to European elections, everything in between, there's roughly 30% of the population who is in any meaningful way engaged with that narrative, right? 30%, which means there's a big mass of people here, about 70%, who don't actually believe
that story, that traditional idea of how we do politics, how we're offered choices, how we make a kind of like our relationship with that, actually means anything to their lives, right? So I think the more meaningful spectrum is not the left to right, but it's the engaged and the disengaged, the connected and the disconnected. This is a very large attack surface, and this is where, this is the hunting territory for demagogues and forces that are against the idea of open society. So my posit really is that liberal, Western, democratic, open society order is under deliberate attack, and this is the attack surface that's being targeted for that. Now, how is this happening? So there's two guys who you should be familiar with. The first is a guy called Valery Gerasimov. He's the author of the Gerasimov Doctrine, which is essentially the current Russian military doctrine of nonlinear warfare. And that's the thing that says that warfare isn't just a thing that we do with tanks and going over borders anymore. Warfare is about projecting power in a variety of different means, and largely including things like strategic disinformation campaigns and things like that. The stuff that we're seeing, that we've been seeing, or that's being questioned and unpicked now in relation to the American election and stuff. And there are different components and elements of that. So we've got Gerasimov, who has written the Gerasimov Doctrine. You can look this up on the internet and read it. It's translated in English. It's not hidden anywhere. It's a full-spectrum war new doctrine that's currently being used. The other guy we need to know about is a guy called Vladislav Surkov. He is sometimes referred to as the Eminence Grise of the Putin regime. If you've watched Hypernormalization by Adam Curtis, he pops up as this former theater director who's now a political technologist. And he formed, for example, the Russian youth group Nashi, you know, our nation. And then his brilliant coup, so they manufactured a young base of support for the Putin ideology. They call this sovereign democracy, right? We decide what's best for you, and we call it democracy, and you don't question it, and that's good enough, right? Then this guy also created the opposition groups to Nashi, right? So he created a tension within society, saying we have a groundswell of opinion that's for the regime, and there's these bad kind of like contrarian forces. And then what he did was he declared publicly, I engineered both of those, right? Just out and said it. I have created all of this. And the people within the system end up in a state of confusion where they don't really know what's what and what's right and what's wrong. And this is the central idea of the kind of hybrid nonlinear warfare doctrine in the information space, is to create a space, create a state of confusion where nobody can trust any formal, any authoritative version of the truth. So for example, when MH17 was shot down, within the following week, five different versions of what had happened were put out by the different instruments of the Russian state, including one which said, oh, do you remember that other Malaysian airplane flight that got lost in the Pacific? Well, it never got lost. They landed it somewhere. They killed everybody. They collected the bodies. They put them in that plane, and then they crashed it in the Ukraine in order to kind of like, do messages against our activities there and stuff. So a few concepts that I'll articulate within that. Maskirovka, right? This is old concept. It goes back to like the Czechists, the Cheka, the original KGB guys. And what Maskirovka says is that you make, wherever you have an opportunity, you make something look like something else. So the little green men, when they showed up in Crimea, they didn't look like the Russian army. They initially looked like there's some civil tension and some paramilitary forces have materialized in order to protect state institutions. Well, later we find out that these were kind of Spetsnaz and Russian naval infantry special forces who just weren't wearing badges and stuff. So that's an example of Maskirovka. You make something, but you make it look like it might be something else. And sometimes it's just to buy enough time to create facts on the ground. Another one is provokatsiya. And this, again, is an instrument of the state apparatus from the Czechist day. So provokatsiya is like provocations, I think. A recent example, which doesn't involve soldiers and stuff, is Eurovision Song Contest week.
So the Putin regime put forward as the Russian entry into the Eurovision Song Contest is a disabled wheelchair-bound singer. So they put them in, they got put onto the roster. Following that, they organized a concert for this singer in Crimea, which is occupied, and by Ukraine law, then denies that person, that individual, the right to enter into the Ukraine by legal means. And they knew that this would be the consequence of that, and this was engineered to create a situation in which, aren't the Ukrainians such terrible people that they don't let a wheelchair-bound athlete participate in the Eurovision Song Contest? And call it cynical, but it's completely engineered just in order to create those kind of situations. Another one is propaganda, and I'll read you like the Russian explanation of that, which is the targeted incapacitation of the citizen by behavioral control. That's a Russian doctrine version of that. So it's like, talk some of these other elements, we get back on that. Reflexive control, to take advantage of our psychological weakness and knock out our critical thinking. Now, reflexive control has been supremely effective in the Russian activities in the elections in the West. So, in pure doctrine terms, Putin has a stated goal of destroying the European Union, right? He doesn't vocalize that very publicly outside to foreign audiences, but it's a very strong message to domestic audiences. I will destroy the European Union, and Russia will reassert its control over its traditional spheres of influence. And they pursue that objective through a variety of means, like funding the Front National in France, but also by using its instruments of information pollution in a variety of narratives where national populations are having discourse and debates about decisions about their future, right? So it is not right, I think, to say that Trump is a Putin, you know, like a tool of Putin who has been placed there. He's a Manchurian candidate. It is entirely correct to say that wherever there was an opportunity in the information landscape to kind of sow chaos within the democratic discourse and the system, the Putin regime was primed and actively ready to do so. So it's no surprise that the information that was leaked out was the Democratic Party emails in the timing that they were through the instruments of WikiLeaks. They also have the Republican, but they haven't chosen to release them. So I think what I'm trying to say is that you can't, in this hybrid war, nonlinear warfare, information polluted landscape, you can't draw like specific, ooh, they did that and that had that causal effect, and therefore they're the bad guys and what have you. But you need to have this kind of questioning all the time, in whose interest is the fact that these curious things are going on, and can we trace it back to a particular foreign policy doctrine? Two other bits, I think I'm running out of time, and I'd like to open to questions, but things that are kind of instruments of our own creation are filter bubbles, right? Which are kind of like digital prisons for our own thinking, and echo chambers, which is the social polarization into separate groups that no longer understand each other. Now, in some sense, the social communication technologies that we've built have kind of enabled, and the media landscape in the way that it has been evolved, are kind of our own doing, but let's recognize that these things are form part of the attack surface that can be exploited. So I don't know what your echo chamber or your filter bubble looks like, but I know that in my echo chamber and my filter bubble, there are some pieces of information that are being put in there that are kind of like strictly engineered to make me start questioning some of my assumptions about whether I feel confident in particular opinions I've got, and to open my mind space to consider other things. And these are being like, we've all heard the stories of Cambridge Analytica where they supposedly can do that like targeted at an individual level. I'm not sure I buy that yet, but people are doing these things. And then just ask yourself, in the last question I'll leave you with in terms of reflexive control, where in the recent past do you feel like in consensus group decision making, bodies of people have been driven to make decisions which ultimately are completely against their self-interest, their actual self-interest, yeah? And that's a pretty good indicator of where to start looking for these kind of like hybrid warfare activities. So I'll leave that there, and I don't know if we've got time.
I have one or two questions.
Yeah, all right, cool.
Should the comments section of the newspaper website be closed down? Just a waste of time.
Can you repeat the question?
Should the comments sections of newspaper website be closed down? No, I don't, because ultimately the other goal is to kind of shut down democratic decision. I think we need to be smarter, and we could moderate in more intelligent ways, and we could have like flags saying, this looks suspiciously like there's sometimes you get a ping on your email saying, it looks like a state-sponsored actor is trying to interfere with your shit. So having mechanisms like that, I think, might be useful.
A classic example of it that comes to mind is in 2006, sorry, when George Bush said that Chinese routers being sold in the US were being used to relay information back to China. And then you had the Snowden leaks, then it became clear that, you know, an awful lot of Western companies are doing exactly the same. I'm just a bit concerned that everything that you've done has really been focused on Russia against us, as opposed to things that we do as well, because, you know, our departments have the same decision unit that they have.
Sure.
So I think when we do that with us, when we just focus on Russia or any other country, it's actually almost a thing. Disinformation in its own.
Yeah. Okay, so I will just finish by saying the reason why I focus, my story focused on Russia is because they have very specifically engineered this doctrine, and the elements of those activities are the ones that are arrayed against the idea of open society and the Western liberal order. Yes, this is a full spectrum war, has many sides, and I hope our side has better tools, and we're doing stuff like that, but as a passive society, being like unwitting contributors to somebody else's objectives without having the kind of like the clarity of mind or the digital literacy to even recognize what's going on, I think we can defend against. But yeah, this goes both ways.
I have to leave it there.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
Just want to thank all three speakers, and next up in here is a board game.